Welcome to the New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I am professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, and I co-host the channel with Carrie Figdor. Today, my guest is Professor Cheryl Misak. Cheryl is professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto. We'll be talking about her new book, The American Pragmatists, which has just been published with Oxford University Press. Pragmatism is America's homegrown philosophy, but it's not widely understood. This partly is due to the fact that pragmatism emerged out of deep philosophical disputes among its earliest proponents, Charles Sanders Peirce, William James, and John Dewey. Although it is agreed that they are the founders of pragmatism, they also held opposing views about meaning, truth, reality, and value. A further complication emerges in that it is widely believed that pragmatism was purged from the philosophical mainstream and rendered dormant sometime around 1950, but then recovered only in the 1980s by Richard Rorty. In her new book, Professor Misak presents a nuanced analysis of the origins, development, and prospects of pragmatism. She shows that pragmatism has always come in a variety of flavors, ranging from the highly objectivist views of Peirce and Lewis to the more subjectivist commitments of James and Rorty. More importantly, Misak demonstrates that pragmatism has been a constantly evolving philosophical movement that has consistently shaped and formed the landscape of English language philosophy. On Misak's account, pragmatism is the philosophical thread that runs through the work of the most influential philosophers of the past century: Peirce, James, Dewey, Lewis, Goodman, Quine, Sellars, Putnam, Rorty, and beyond. Her book will be of interest to anyone with interests in pragmatism or in 20th century philosophy. So let's now turn to the interview. Hello, Cheryl Misak.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Philosophy.
It's my pleasure.
Today on New Books in Philosophy, my guest is Professor Cheryl Misak. Cheryl has just published a book titled The American Pragmatists with Oxford University Press. Now, I highly recommend this book, and I recommend it not only to those who may be listening who have an interest in pragmatism as a philosophical tradition and movement, but I also recommend it to those with interests in 20th century and indeed 21st century philosophy. In her book, Cheryl manages to strike a very admirable and delicate balance between historical narrative and telling the story of the development of pragmatism as a philosophical movement, philosophical exegesis, and telling, giving accounts, philosophical accounts of what pragmatists tend to think and how they argue for distinctive philosophical theses, and also first order philosophical argument of her own, where Cheryl defends certain philosophical claims that may have their origin in historical pragmatist texts, but Cheryl makes her own case for, in many cases, novel interpretations of those theses. So the book results in something I would say it's very exciting. We emerge from Cheryl Misak's The American Pragmatists with a new understanding of pragmatism, both as a historical tradition, an ongoing historical tradition, and as a living philosophy and still emerging and growing philosophical program. So there's a lot to discuss, but before we get into the details of the book, Cheryl, why don't you tell our listeners something about yourself?
Thanks for your kind words, Bob. So I was born in a place called Lethbridge, Alberta, which is within cycling distance from Sweetgrass, Montana, and perhaps that's all the listener needs to know about where I come from. And I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Lethbridge, then went to work with Isaac Levi at Columbia, where I did a master's degree, starting to think more carefully through some pragmatist themes. And then I went to Oxford, which may seem like the least likeliest place anywhere to work on American pragmatism, but actually it was an enormously fruitful place to study. I worked with David Wiggins, who is one of the very best and finest interpreters of Peirce's thought, and also with Susan Haack, who was then at Warwick, and Chris Hookway, who was at that point at Birmingham. So I was exceedingly well supervised in what might be thought to be the least likely place to work on American pragmatism. For about the last 20-some years, I've been at the University of Toronto, and although I still consider myself very much a jobbing philosopher, I have a day job as provost of the university, which keeps me mighty busy, but I have found time to write this book. It's taken me an awfully long time, but as I tell myself, it perhaps was a very good thing that it took me so long to write it, because it is perhaps more careful than it otherwise would have been.
Well, excellent. So let's launch in to talking about the book. Now, let me begin with just a little background, and then I've got a series of questions about how the book proceeds. A common line that is often taken on pragmatism, which I suspect our listeners will be familiar with in some form or another, has it that pragmatism is an intellectual, philosophical movement that begins with Charles Peirce, William James, and John Dewey. It enjoys some prominence in the early 20th century, particularly for the decades before the Second World War. But then it falls out of favor following the Second World War, sometime in the late 40s and 50s. But then it gets revived or rejuvenated, mostly by neo-pragmatists like Richard Rorty. Now, your book resists this narrative or common story on several fronts, and I want to talk about some of the ways in which your account of the development of pragmatism and its current state departs from this account. But one thing that struck me about your book, The American Pragmatists, is that you have a whole chapter about Chauncey Wright, who was a contemporary of Peirce and James and a member of the Metaphysical Club, which is this informal gathering of folks around Cambridge where some of these core pragmatist ideas were first proposed and developed. And you even called Chauncey Wright one of the founders of pragmatism. I take it that many of our listeners will never have read anything by Chauncey Wright and might not have heard the name before and might not know anything about him otherwise. Can you tell us a little bit about Chauncey Wright as a philosopher, and then why you think that he is among the founders of pragmatism?
So one of the wonderful things that I discovered in writing this this book, which really started off as being a history of, and finished off as being a history of the whole of pragmatism from the beginning till now, is that I discovered true gems that had been somehow forgotten over the last decades in philosophy. Chauncey Wright's case, many, many decades. So Chauncey Wright was certainly thought by the founders of pragmatism, Peirce, James, Oliver Wendell Holmes, to be one of the founders of pragmatism. And in fact, Peirce called him our boxing master. They all thought that Chauncey Wright had taught them most of what they knew, and they looked up to him as the really, really smart guy in the room. Chauncey Wright also had Darwin share this view of him. Darwin had been in correspondence with Wright and had published a pamphlet of Wright's on symmetry in the petals of flowers. And he was just one of the leading minds of the time. He, like Peirce, never managed to get himself a proper job in academic philosophy. He was a computer for a mathematical organization and found a bunch of shortcuts to let him do all of his year's work of computing in a few months. And then he spent the rest of the year staying up too late, drinking too much, smoking too much, talking too much, and burned himself out and died altogether too young. Didn't write very much. And this is why we don't know all that much about him. But Chauncey Wright is critical for understanding the origins of pragmatism, because Wright was a little bit older than Peirce and James and Holmes, and was this kind of guiding spirit behind pragmatism. And Wright was very clearly working within the British empiricist tradition. So Hamilton, Bain, Mill, these were the people that Wright was so heavily engaged with. And when you look at James and his radical empiricism and at Peirce's work, you get the sense that this that pragmatism is very much in the empiricist tradition, and yet you find Peirce hardly mentioning Hume, James hardly mentioning Hume, and really... with the exception of some of James's work, not much focus on the empiricism that is built into pragmatism. And I think a lot of this is because they took it for granted that this was where they were coming from, and they expected everyone to see it. But with Chauncey Wright, that comes out very, very strongly. And in order to understand the origins of pragmatism, you have to understand what philosophers Chauncey Wright and Peirce and James were really intellectually engaged with. And besides the British empiricists, it was Auguste Comte. So they really thought of themselves as being a part of the positivist movement, and that's why there's this strain of verificationism, to be anachronistic, in their thought. So they were verificationists before the logical empiricists arrived on the scene, but verificationists in a much broader sense, where they wanted to not merely bring value under empiricist principles and maybe find it drummed out of the scientific enterprise, but actually bring value under the empiricist tent and make sure that that our empiricist worldview made room for value and art and other things that fell by the wayside when the logical empiricist came along. So understanding Chauncey Wright is critical in understanding the whole arc of American pragmatism, including the arc that spans the period of time when the logical empiricists came to the shores of America.
Well, okay, excellent. So let's then pick up on particularly the Peirce and James relation, which is a theme running through your treatment of these two figures early in the book, because the answer you just gave sort of emphasized some of the common ground between them. They are of a kind of empiricist. There are in both Peirce and James certain kinds of verificationist, or what we now recognize as verificationist tendencies. Certainly, the idea that philosophical ideas get their content from their connection to experience or practice or various kinds of doings and undergoings. But part of your story is a story about a struggle, particularly between Peirce and James, but then eventually between Peirce, James, and Dewey, over the meaning of the kind of empiricism that pragmatists are committed to, and maybe even if it's right to put it this way, a struggle over the meaning of the pragmatic maxim and the conception of truth that pragmatists are famous for championing. Can you sketch for us a little bit of that part of the story?
Good. So this really, as you note, is the very heart of pragmatism, the idea that all of our philosophical concepts need to be linked to our practices. So the pragmatic maxim in Peirce's hands, at least the versions of the pragmatic maxim that I think are best, are of the following sort. He says that we have to look to the upshot of our concepts in order to rightly apprehend them or understand them. So Peirce backs all of his thoughts about pragmatism and the pragmatic maxim with an extraordinarily complex account of meanings in a theory of the signs of signs, and all of that is well worth careful attention. But for these purposes, really, what we need to understand in terms of the dynamic between Peirce and James is it. Peirce's pragmatic maxim was adopted by James, and that maxim is, you, in order to understand a concept in philosophy or any kind of concept, you need to see how it cashes out in action. And so when they turned that maxim on the concept of truth, Peirce arrived at the following. A belief is true if it would stand up to whatever reasons, evidence, argument that belief would be exposed to. So a belief is true if it would be indefeasible or not defeated by whatever it might encounter. In James's hand, the maxim played out very differently. James said, well, a belief is true if it's good to believe. And what's good to believe, James said, will differ from society to society, but also from person to person. So he is infamous for arguing in The Will to Believe that if a belief would be good for me and maybe not so good for you, and let's take his most infamous example in that paper, if the belief in God were good for me to believe, if it had positive consequences for my life, and it didn't have the same positive consequences for your life, then I would be justified in believing that it was true and it would be true for me, and you could just equally as justifiably not move towards that belief, and it would not be true for you. So here we have one maxim. If you want to understand what truth is, look to how it plays out in our practices of deliberation and inquiry and the like. And you, with Peirce, you get something. All of these words are problematic, but something more realist. You get, if a belief were to stand up to all the evidence and all the argument and reason for and against it, then it, if it really were indefeasible, it would be true. And with James, you get, if a belief is good in some much looser sense of good for me to believe, then it's true. So Peirce, James, and Chauncey Wright wrangled over this, and some of the wrangling is highly entertaining, but also really illuminating in terms of seeing just how early on these divisions in the pragmatist tradition manifested themselves. So Peirce said of James's The Will to Believe that paper and the thesis in it injures a serious man very much. So just not something a serious man should be going near. And Chauncey Wright has a wonderful set of correspondence about The Will to Believe in its early drafts. So James had flagged his thoughts that would eventually appear in that famous paper in a few remarks published in The Nation. And Chauncey Wright, and everyone, because James was already famous and well thought of, Chauncey Wright read these remarks in The Nation and then wrote letters saying, I've set a plan in action where I'm going to lie in wait for our friend William and take him on about these silly things that he says in The Nation. And so one of his two occasions where he lies in wait for James is at James's father's house, and he says in one of these letters, I said to the youth, to James. James asks him whether he's read the remarks in the Nation, and Chauncey Wright says yes, and James says, and you know, did they seem good to you? And Chauncey Wright says, well, I didn't find any typographical errors in the document. And then he launches into an attack on these ideas, which in that early instance, James had made even stronger than in that that still strong paper, The Will to Believe, where James said, if a belief is good for me to believe, then I have a duty to believe it. And Chauncey Wright argued him into the ground, saying that the most you can say, even that is excessive, but the most you can say is that you have a right to believe it, not that you have a duty to believe it. So they were, James Wright and Peirce, were wrangling over these issues right from minute one. And it's very interesting to see that these very divides are still very present in the pragmatist tradition. And, you know, I think they're present in the pragmatist tradition because they speak to important issues that, you know, are not about to go away. So I don't think it's a bad thing that pragmatists are still lining up either on the Peirce Wright, more objective side of the scale and on the Jamesian, I would say Deweyian, and then certainly Rortian, you know, radically subjective side of the scale. My book is very much an argument that Peirce, James, Peirce, Lewis, and Wright are right, that it's much better to be an objective pragmatist than a radically subjective pragmatist.
Right. So let me ask you just a quick follow-up question about Peirce. And I know that many of our listeners will also know that a lot of your previous work has been focused on defending a particular version or interpretation of Peirce's infamous, I think it's safe to say, end of inquiry conception of truth. These issues come up in your current book as well. As you presented Peirce's view of truth, you used a lot of would-be's and woulds, a lot of terms that sound modal in a way that might be suspicious to naturalist empiricists who might have some qualms about would-be's. As I understand it from reading your book, Peirce himself struggled with the modal force of the what would stand up to attempts to undermine it, or what would respond well to subsequent testing and scrutiny, particularly when it comes to questions of in some of his writings about diamonds that never get put to the test, whether they can be called hard or things hard only if you actually perform the test of scratching them. Can you tell us a little bit about Peirce's own sort of struggle with what we might think of as sort of more nominalist, flat-footed interpretations of the pragmatic maxim and of his subsequent consequent theory of truth, and some of the subsequent ways that he employs in trying to solve some problems with it?
Yes, so Peirce corrected a mistake that he made in that very early How to Make Our Ideas Clear paper. So let's just take a step back and remember that Peirce hardly published a thing. So he couldn't find a job in academia and spent his life as a working for the U.S. Coast Survey, and when he was a difficult guy, and eventually got turfed from that job, and then spent the rest of his life up in his cold attic with not enough food, writing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of philosophy, the vast bulk of it never really to see the light of day, still not really to see the light of day. So a very few early papers of Peirce's were published in the Popular Science Monthly, and Peirce bemoaned the fact that he had to publish in that journal, and hence he said, tailor what he said to a very certain kind of audience. But in that early How to Make Our Ideas Clear paper, where he uses the indicative conditional, if a diamond lies on the bottom of the ocean floor and is never scratched, then what sense does it make to say that it's hard, because no one will scratch it and it won't be tested and hence is not hard. And very soon after the publication of that paper, he realized he just made a mistake, and he spent the rest of his life trying to correct it, saying, I replace that is, that indicative, with a would be, with a subjunctive conditional. So were a diamond to lie on the bottom of the ocean floor and never be scratched, you can still say of it, were it to be scratched, then it would resist, and hence it is hard. And so he, you're right, he wanted not only to invoke that subjunctive conditional when it came to both unpacking the notion of meaning and unpacking the notion of truth, but he also spent a lot of time talking about whether would-bes, if you like, can be said to exist in some way. So he was an antinomalist, and as you also pointed out, this seems to pull against the naturalist strains that lie at the very heart of empiricist and pragmatist views. But this is actually what distinguishes pragmatism from many other varieties of empiricism. And the best way to see this is to look at Peirce and then the pragmatist who is his successor, and that's C.I. Lewis. Okay. So both Peirce and Lewis wanted to make room in their logics, and both were crackerjack logicians, crackerjack formal logicians, for modal logic. So in the very same way that pragmatists want to make room in their empiricism for value judgments as being genuinely and robustly judgments that respond to experience, it's just not going to be the kind of sensory experience that that other kinds of inquiries into middle-sized dry goods are responsive to. They wanted to say that the subjunctive and would-bes and modal notions are as real as other kinds as real as the indicative. So this is something that distinguishes pragmatism from other kinds of empiricism, and it's critical in work of Peirce, and it's critical in the work of Lewis. And both Peirce and Lewis sometimes say the following. Look, if you want to understand what we're getting at, let's say we, Peirce says, you want, and Lewis says, if you want to understand what I'm getting at when I invoke a subjunctive conditional here, think of it this way. We hope that our investigations would result in an upshot. And that hope is really what we're talking about when we express our account of truth in terms of a subjunctive conditional.
Right. One further question, just to pick up on this, particularly about the way this issue plays out in the Peircean account of truth. So a moment ago, when you presented the Peircean thought of truth and contrasted it nicely, I thought, with the Jamesian thought, you were able to identify Peirce's view of truth without making any mention of the thing that has come to haunt Peirce's remarks on truth, which is a series of clumsy, I take it, and maybe at the end of the day, unintentional or not fully intended references to something called the end of inquiry or the ideal community of inquirers. So the thought is, it's typically expressed as, and I'm now putting it in a way that makes it overtly silly. Peirce thought that truth was what the ideal community of inquirers would believe at the ideal end of inquiry. Now, your way of presenting the Peircean view of truth makes no mention of either of those devices. Can you say something about that?
Yeah. So that's completely right. This one phrase has haunted the pragmatist account of truth since Peirce penned it. So he I think only once mentions the ideal end of inquiry, and I think only once mentions the opinion that is fated to be agreed upon at the end of inquiry. And these snappy summaries of his view of truth have stuck to the pragmatist view, much to its misfortune. So again, one has to understand that Peirce hardly published anything. And if you want to really get a grip on what he thought about truth, you have to read this vast array of material. And what he was trying to get at in these very, as you say, clumsy attempts at giving snappy summaries of his view of truth is just this idea that we were talking about before. So how do you unpack this very cumbersome idea of a belief that would stand up to everything you could throw at it for into the indefinite future? Well, one way of capturing it is to say, as Peirce sometimes, actually very frequently said, we hope that our inquiry, the one that we're engaged in here and now, would result in an upshot that just couldn't be improved upon. That was what he more often than not said that his account of truth was. On occasion, he took another flyer at saying what it was. He said, well, so what I'm trying to say is the belief that is fated to be agreed upon at the end of inquiry is what truth amounts to. And that just is so problematic. He saw the problems. He tried to, you know, tinker with them. And then he abandoned that way of putting the point. But as you and I both know, that is what has stuck. And I am trying very much to unstick that snappy summary from the pragmatist account of truth, at least the Peircean pragmatist account of truth. It's not his considered view. And it's just unfortunate and unfair that that's what seems to have stuck.
Right. So this provides an occasion to ask you before we move on to something else I want to ask you about, which is I do want to hear more about the role that Lewis and Quine in particular play in your story of pragmatism. But while we're speaking about Peirce and truth, I want to just ask you to speak a little bit more about John Dewey and the role that he plays in your story. I mentioned Dewey at this point because there is an often cited footnote in John Dewey's 1938 book on logic, where Dewey praises Peirce's conception of truth. The Peirce gives the best definition of truth there is. And then Dewey attributes to Peirce the end of inquiry view that you've just tried to distance pragmatism and even Peirce himself from. So can you tell us a little bit about where Dewey fits in? Earlier you put Dewey and James into the same category as the non-Peircean interpretation or the non-Peircean strand, the more subjectivist strand in pragmatism. But can you fill us in a little bit more on where Dewey's philosophy resides in this narrative?
Yeah, so that really is a major question in the trajectory of pragmatism. So the received view goes like this. Peirce and James founded this doctrine in 1870s, and Dewey picked it up and was, after James's great glory as America's most eminent philosopher and academic, again, America's most eminent philosopher and academic. And then somehow, after Dewey's death, pragmatism just disappeared from the philosophical scene. And then the received view has it that it disappeared from the philosophical scene because those bully boys, the logical empiricists, came around and just chased pragmatism out of the best philosophy departments in America. And you, Bob, have this lovely term for this received view. You call it the eclipse view. And you and I both agree that it's a wrong-headed view of the history of American pragmatism. So what's the right view? Well, and actually, let me throw in another view that is even more wrong-headed, and that's the Menand view, right? So Louis Menand, in this best-selling and Pulitzer Prize-winning book called The Metaphysical Club, which was the club that Peirce, Chauncey Wright, William James, and Oliver Wendell Holmes founded in 1867, where pragmatism was born. Menand argues for, I should choose my words carefully here, I want to say lunatic view. Menand argues for a very unusual view of the history of American pragmatism. He takes pragmatism to be more or less Richard Rorty's view, and quite rightly says that this is the view that that James had, but he identifies pragmatism in 1867 with Richard Rorty's very, let's call it subjectivist view, and says that after the Civil War was such a searing event for Americans that at the end of it, they were just really sick of the ideas of certainty and confidence, and they wanted nothing to do with anyone who said that they knew the truth about anything. Look where the truth got them. It got them all of the horror and bloodshed of the Civil War. So pragmatism was born out of that desire to not have views of truth that invoked any kind of certainty. Once the Cold War came along, people wanted certainty again, and so pragmatism was in the doghouse. And when the Cold War ceased to become an urgent thing on people's minds, certain uncertainty could rule again, and hence Richard Rorty would come in with pragmatism and make it popular again. This is just so far from what was actually happening on the philosophical ground that that part of what I want to do in this book is correct both that received view and Menand view. So what is what is the accurate story of the trajectory of pragmatism, and where does Dewey fit into it? So my on the account that I give, we had C.S. Peirce, Chauncey Wright, William James, Oliver Wendell Holmes carve out a view of truth that spoke about the role that truth plays in our practices and links truth to our practices of inquiry and investigation. We have two different kinds of pragmatism growing out of that metaphysical club. One is the more subjectivist Jamesian view, and one is the more objectivist Peirce-Wright view, Peirce and Chauncey Wright view. And then you have, with James's death, Dewey taking over, and the view after Dewey's death seeming to fall far, far, far into the backwoods. So I think this is not, as I say, an accurate account of the trajectory of pragmatism. What you have at the end of the James Peirce period is C.I. Lewis taking that famous course from William James and Josiah Royce, where they did battle over pragmatism and empiricism, or sorry, pragmatism and idealism, with James arguing for pragmatism and Royce arguing for idealism. you had C.I. Lewis taking that famous course at Harvard as an undergraduate, siding, it's not clear where he was siding as an undergraduate, but at the end of the day, he came out very much in favor of the Peircean, more objective view of pragmatism. And you had John Dewey actually pick up the idealism of Royce and others and present a kind of quasi-pragmatism that I want to argue really derailed pragmatism as a movement. It's a bit more complicated than that, because an essential part of my story is this. If you look at what C.I. Lewis did with that Peircean account of pragmatism, you see that view not only continue in American philosophy, but actually flourish and be the dominant view of philosophy in America. So Lewis was Quine. Quine took his view directly from Lewis, unacknowledged. It's actually one of the most shocking episodes, I think, in the history of philosophy, how Lewis's student, Quine, adopted Lewis's view wholesale, unacknowledged, and then took it forward, sometimes calling it pragmatism, sometimes not, but demolishing his teacher, saying his teacher, Lewis, was an advocate of, or sucked into the myth of the given and the analytic-synthetic distinction, both of which are just complete and utter falsehoods. But you have the view of Lewis and Peirce continue through American philosophy in the hands of Quine, Goodman, Sellars, and many others today, but it's not called pragmatism anymore. It's called something else. So my story is one where Dewey is a kind of almost a distraction, in that he led pragmatism off to a certain kind of pragmatism off to a dead end. And if you follow that promising trail, the one that starts with Peirce and goes through to Lewis and then Quine and Sellars, you see that pragmatism is actually alive and very, very well.
Well, can you tell us then a little bit about what you think the distinctive contributions of Lewis were to the pragmatist tradition? Now, I take it that our listeners will be familiar with Lewis because of the, I still think, regarded as a groundbreaking work on modal logic. And I also take it that the famous paper on the pragmatic conception of the a priori and certain other parts, certain other things that became the Mind and the World Order book are probably well enough known generally. But Lewis, I think you're right to have suggested Lewis is no longer read in the way that he was certainly in his lifetime and shortly following his death. We've sort of written him out of the story of philosophy in America in a lot of ways. So what are we missing by not looking carefully at Lewis's work?
So we're missing a lot. And I'm the first to say that you know that I missed it the first time around as well. So you know, I wrote a book on pragmatism and ethics and politics, pragmatism and value, and argued that if you looked at Peirce's view, you could find some really interesting sustainable things to say about value that really stood up to all of the pressing questions and the excellent debates that we currently have about value and objectivity. And I wrote this book kind of sidestepping Dewey, because although Dewey seemed to me to be the pragmatist who spoke about value and who put value on our radar screens in such an effective way, he didn't actually have the answers in his own brand of pragmatism. And I managed to write this whole book without understanding that C.I. Lewis actually is the not just the pragmatist we should all be turning to if we want to understand value and objectivity, but the philosopher we should turn to if we want to come to a good understanding about this important set of issues. And I had read Lewis as an undergraduate in my second year in that callow undergraduate way, and then had sort of packed him off in the back of my mind as someone I had read and thought at the time that I understood, and then hadn't encountered him again in the rest of not only my education, but in the rest of my attending philosophy colloquia and conferences. He was just absent from the philosophical scene, even though my philosophical scene was the pragmatist scene. Right. That's really striking. It's also really striking that, as I said a few minutes ago, if you look at Quine's work, you can take Quine's most important passages and set them against passages of Lewis's, and you wouldn't know from whose pen each passage came from. The views are identical. Nonetheless, Quine and Goodman and Morton White, all Lewis's students, lowered their guns and tried to blow off their teacher's head about the analytic and synthetic, saying that Lewis, had some outdated and foolhardy distinction between the analytic and synthetic. False. Lewis had precisely Quine's view that the framework questions, the questions that we held true come what may, were things that were chosen, and we could, by doing a lot of damage to our conceptual framework, by making lots and lots of revisions, we could revise those framework beliefs, and they were all fallible. And I think if you have a view of the analytic or the a priori where those sentences are fallible, you don't have the kind of bifurcation that Quine and others were railing against. They also said that Lewis was an adoptee of the myth of the given, and it is just crystal clear that he was not. He also took experiential inputs to be experiential beliefs to be fallible. What he wanted to do, though, was to distance himself from Dewey's brand of pragmatism, where Dewey was only looking forward. How does this belief change the knowledge situation in the future? Lewis thought that in order to assess whether a belief is true or worth believing, you also had to take a look at its precedents, not only how it will play out in the future, and see if it's grounded in experience in the right kind of way. Not grounded with certainty, but if it has some kind of experiential touchstone. So Lewis really was the pragmatist. And remember, Lewis and Dewey were alive at the same time, and they engaged with each other. They both looked at each other's views and thought them quite foreign, despite the fact that they were the two famous pragmatists in the world. But Lewis wanted to have a pragmatism where you could make sense of the ideas of making a mistake, of learning something, of coming to a better view, and of distinguishing between what is valuable to me or what seems valuable and what really is valuable. And you'll find a parallel distinction in his more general view of truth. You have to be able to distinguish between what seems true to me or to us and what really is true. And that distinction in Lewis's pragmatism and in Peirce's pragmatism is what I want in this book to point to as the kind of pragmatism that we should all be interested in. So this kind of pragmatism says, this kind of pragmatist says, look, you can't talk about truth without talking about human practices of inquiry and deliberation and investigation. And you can't talk about value without talking about what's valuable to human beings, what human beings experience as valuable. So in James's view, the trail of the human serpent is over everything. But this kind of pragmatist, the Peirce Lewis kind of pragmatist, says you still need to make sense of the idea of making a mistake, improving your belief, and you still need to hold on to that distinction between what seems to me to be valuable, what seems to me to be true, and what really is valuable and what really is true. And Dewey didn't always hold on to that distinction, neither did his successor, Rorty. But that other kind of pragmatism, the kind that started with Peirce and Lewis, that is actually the naturalist project that we find so many people now completely engaged in and embedded in.
Right. So this also now provides an occasion for wondering about the ninth chapter of the book, which is titled The Rise of Logical Empiricism. So if on your account, pragmatists, both in the what you're now calling the Peirce Lewis trajectory and this other trajectory, which you're associating with James and Dewey and eventually Rorty, if they're both trying in some way to preserve an account of value while remaining respectable naturalist empiricists, what's the role of the logical empiricist in this story, such that logical empiricism deserves a chapter? One might think, well, the logical empiricists have to be anti-pragmatists. And one way we might even see that on the account that you've already sketched, Cheryl, is, well, the logical empiricists, you know, if we know them as anything, we know them as people who think that, there aren't, value judgments, can't be correct or incorrect or true or false. They're just, hoorays and boos. So what's the role of the logical empiricist in the story then?
Good. So the role is absolutely critical, and it's critical in two ways. So again, let's just first take a step back and think of this trajectory. You've got Peirce and James, and then Dewey and Lewis in the continuous next generation. When Dewey and Lewis are at their height, the logical empiricists come to America. And then in the next generation, you have Quine, Lewis's student, being critical of logical empiricism, but still continuing in that naturalist tradition and leading to some of the current naturalisms we see today. So one reason it's important to talk about logical empiricism is that the logical empiricists are just a continuous part of this story. But the much more interesting reason to talk about them is that when the logical empiricists came to America, they did not, as the received view would have it, find a homegrown philosophy that was set against their scientific, logical way of approaching the central questions and the central methodology of philosophy. So as I said very early on, Chauncey Wright and Peirce and James all thought of themselves as being engaged in the positivist project as Auguste Comte had carved it out. It's interesting they didn't talk much about Hume and the other British empiricists. But they had a kind of verificationism embedded in the pragmatic maxim, and their definition of belief was Bain's definition of belief. It was a dispositional definition of belief. So when the logical empiricists came to America, they found a homegrown philosophy that was very, very like their own. And in fact, they saw Dewey as akin as a brother of theirs. And Dewey was on the editorial board of the Encyclopedia of Unified Science. He was one of the co-authors of the introductory volume. And then he was the sole author of another volume. And that volume was called A Theory of Valuation. And at that point, Dewey and the logical empiricists all thought of themselves as being engaged in the very same project. And that was bringing all aspects of human endeavor under the principles of science. And you can dip into any volume of Dewey and just hear this again and again and again. That's what he was doing. He's bringing value into the realm of science. The difference is, the difference between Dewey and the logical empiricists actually is twofold. One, and I alluded to this earlier, Dewey and all the other pragmatists had a commitment to retain a place for value, whereas the logical empiricists were open-minded about this. Either there would be a place for value, it would be kind of scientific look at value judgments, or perhaps value judgments would be declared meaningless. And hence you get the infamous Boo-Hurrah theory of meaning, what Lewis called the ejaculatory theory of meaning. So that was one difference, right? So the pragmatists were committed to finding a place for value and to thinking hard and in a sophisticated way about value. And the empiricists, you know, they were going to see, you know, they were going to toss the dice and see where, tossing the dice is the wrong metaphor. They're going to take a look at value, and it either survived their scrutiny or it didn't. Another difference was that Dewey was no logician, and very soon after he started engaging with the logical empiricists, he started saying disparaging things about logic, and the logical empiricists started to realize that he really couldn't do it. Dewey had been in Peirce's logic class while Peirce was for a very fleeting time an instructor at Johns Hopkins. And there were these wonderful letters from Dewey. He's writing to his professors back home in Vermont saying, "Mr. Peirce thinks that philosophy is logic. I hate this class. I'm dropping it. And I can't do it. I hate it." And he drops the class, and he and Peirce have a very testy relationship for the rest of. And Lewis, on the other hand, was, as I say, a crackerjack logician, and yet he engaged with logical empiricism by arguing with them about value and about modal logic, but seeing that they all shared the same driving theme, which was to think about value and art and science using only empiricist principles, with Lewis a little bit of Kant thrown in, and with Peirce a little bit of Kant thrown in.
Right. Can you now bring us to the latter stage of the book, particularly the last couple of chapters, which in which you deal with the neo-pragmatists, and we've been talking a lot about Richard Rorty sort of on the sidelines of things, but also Hilary Putnam figures into the story. And then can you tell us a little bit about where pragmatism stands today and what the frontiers are for pragmatists?
So for a long time, and certainly when I was a student, Richard Rorty was the face of pragmatism. I was an undergraduate when both Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature was published and Hilary Putnam's Reason, Truth, and History. Mm-hmm. So actually, you know, even that betrays the received view, right? So when I was an undergraduate, you know, these were two big books, two big important books, and these were the two, successors of the two different kinds of pragmatism still slugging it out, you know, 100 years after the birth of pragmatism. So Richard Rorty is very much the successor of especially James, but also Dewey's pragmatism. And Putnam is very much the successor of Peirce and Lewis and Sellers and Goodman. So we see another very interesting issue. I want to say arise, but actually had been lingering in pragmatist thought right from the beginning, but it really became prominent, the idea that perhaps the pragmatist could make use of the disquotationalist account of truth, and that would be all that you need to say about truth. So this is Rorty's big move. On his version of pragmatism, we do not aim at truth. Inquirers have no use for the concepts of truth and objectivity. All truth is a kind. Let's call it redundant. To say that P is true is to say nothing more than P itself. And this thought was indeed always present in pragmatism, this deflationist thought about truth. So truth is not something that goes beyond first order inquiry, right? So on Peirce's view, it doesn't go beyond first order inquiry, in that the upshot of first order inquiry, if it results in a belief that really is indefeasible, is true, is the truth. And for James, the upshot of really local first-order inquiry, like my own, results in the truth. So that kind of deflationist thought was always lingering in the work of the pragmatists. But Rorty really made an explicit move. He said, look, we don't need to talk about truth. All you need to know about truth is that P is true if and only if P. And we've seen a lot of pragmatists and a lot of other people just leap on what I want to call this quick and dirty solution to the problem of truth. Putnam was very clear that this was a quick and dirty solution to the problem of truth, and one that the pragmatist should not adopt as an easy way out. The pragmatist needed to say more about truth than the mere deflationist thought or the mere redundant thought. And here you see, I think, a very, very interesting parting of the ways an interesting parting of the ways between pragmatists that might look new, but actually is not so new. And this will lead me into your final question, which is what am I going to work on next? Mm-hmm. So if you look, so what I'm going to work on next is a book called Cambridge Pragmatism, on how the pragmatism of Cambridge, England, i.e. Frank Ramsey's pragmatism and Wittgenstein's pragmatism, was very, very heavily influenced by, in Ramsey's case, C.S. Peirce, and in Wittgenstein's case, William James. Now, Ramsey is thought by everyone to be one of the most articulate proponents of the redundancy theory of truth. But in fact, Ramsey, when he died at the age of 26, after having founded modern decision theory, two branches of economics, a branch of mathematics, right. He's truly brilliant. When Ramsey died at the age of 26, he was writing a manuscript on pragmatism and truth, where he was very, very clear that that what he wanted to say about truth was first what was captured in the redundancy thought, and that's that there's nothing more to saying that P is true than there is in asserting P, but that was just the first step in a suitable pragmatist account of truth. You had to then go on and say, build norms into your account of truth, and again, kind of make this distinction between the mere assertion that P or the belief that P and that P is really assertable or deserving of our belief or assent, rather than just merely being believed or assented to. So Ramsey Ramsey is the inheritor with Lewis of Peirce's view of truth, and I think that what all pragmatists should be doing right now is taking a hard look at Ramsey's very, very sophisticated and subtle view of truth, and then returning to that Peircean Ramseyan view, and not being tempted by the easy seductions of just resting with the redundancy or the disquotationalist theory.
Well, excellent. We will keep an eye out then for your next book on Cambridge pragmatism. But for now, Cheryl, you've been very, very generous with your time, and I want to thank you for talking to us on New Books in Philosophy about your new book, The American Pragmatists, which is just out, I think maybe even this week, just out with Oxford University Press.
Well, thank you.
I will be in touch with you, and thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now. You've been listening to my interview with Professor Cheryl Misak of the University of Toronto. We were talking about her new book, The American Pragmatists, which is newly published by Oxford University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.